From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. There are a couple of dining rooms and bars around Los Angeles that act as time machines that transport us to a different era and space. Think Musso and Frank's or Formosa Cafe. But then there's Lowry's in Beverly Hills. With medallion-adorned toke-top carvers wheeling around Art Deco silver carts, tableside service has been a signature of the restaurant for years. I still remember the first time that I saw a woman in a starched uniform lift her arm in the air to let the salad dressing fall in a ribbon onto the salad spinning at my table. For a kid, it was like a magic trick. As a young food-obsessed nerd, I had found my Disneyland. How has COVID changed this fixture of Restaurant Row? Longtime server Tiffany Cody is here for this week's edition of In the Weeds.
Hi, everyone. I am Tiffany Cody, and I am a server at Lowry's Beverly Hills. Lowry's opened its doors, I believe the exact date was June 11th, 1938, and have been in existence ever since. I joined the Lowry's team in September of 2005. So I have been working there for 15 years. Going on, it'll be 16 years in September. The experience dining at Lowry's is most like your Sunday family dinner. And as a matter of fact, that is what the owners had in mind when they were coming up with the concept and the feel of Lowry's. They wanted it to be just that, a dinner that you sit down and you have with your family. And I feel that, you know, they have done a great job of doing that, because a lot of families over the years, people have come to celebrate birthdays, anniversaries, special occasions, and that's been translated, and it's been preserved, those type of traditions, and honored. And so it's become a part of people's lives. There are people who have come and celebrated anniversaries, you know, for 50 years. It's just become a staple of what they do to celebrate their own lives and their own families and their own accomplishments. So we definitely are different from other restaurants. The carvers arrive with the beautiful stainless steel carts. They're wearing medallions that are only given to them after they have finished a very rigorous training experience, which can last anywhere from 6 months to a year, to be able to cut the prime rib to the exact weight and precision. And once they've achieved that, we award them with a medal. And when that cart and that carver comes to the table, it's, you know, it's like a show. And then when they begin to cut the meat, it just makes it very special, because you can see the beautiful meat. You can choose the cut that you want, the temperature that you want. And it just adds to the excitement of the meal that you're about to have, to be able to have that on display in front of you. It's like the kitchen is being brought to your table. And that tableside service has become an intrinsic part of what we do and who we are. I actually really do remember a lot about my first week. And what I remembered was when I started, there were mostly female-oriented dining room service kind of style. And that was done because when they were creating Lowry's, they wanted to give women a chance to have these upscale server positions, which had primarily before had only been held by men. So as a younger woman coming in those days, coming into an industry where you had all different ranges of different women who had been serving at Lowry's for quite a number of years, was very amazing. And I learned so much about being a dining room server, about being a waitress just in general. But what I learned quickly about the hospitality aspect of it is that in other restaurants, you would go, you serve the food. At Lowry's, it's way, way more than that. We were there to entertain the guests. A lot of the servers had guests who had come and only been requesting, you know, them for years. They had relationships with the guests. I had never worked anywhere where the interaction between the guests and the servers was so personal and so warming. And I never forget one of the older servers. They kind of took me around from table to table, and, you know, they would introduce me to the guests and say, well, this is, you know, Mr. Such and Such. He's our dentist. He does, you know, a lot of the girls go to him, and just people who worked in all different trades. And it's like all of a sudden there was a community of people, and it extended beyond just dropping a plate of food at someone's table. It was something that I had never experienced. And it really, really taught me how to be a better server and what it means to really take care of someone. When COVID hit, the CDC mandated that all tableside service had to stop. Given the circumstances around the virus, we were no longer able to bring the carts to the table and to do that type of showmanship. But I tell you what, we had a very strong foundation of patrons who, you know, who stuck with us, whether it be they came to order to go, or when we did have outdoor dining, which we did, and that really kept us afloat. To see those familiar faces who had been, you know, in our dining room for years, who just wanted to come to see us and support, you know, it really, really went a long way. We also were able to meet new people, and the culture of what we do was able to, you know, reach out to all of the new people that came to Lawry's as well, because that still remains the same. Even though we weren't in the dining room, how we serve and how we take care of our guests just transcends. So, you know, that is something positive that came out of the experiences that we were able to, you know, hold on to our patrons from before, and we gained some new customers as well. If it's your first time to Lawry's, I would recommend getting the prime rib. The prime rib is cooked in a convection oven for 3.5 hours. So you're talking about a very slow roasted piece of prime rib, which is going to be extremely tender. It's going to melt in your mouth. Of course, it's prepared with our famous Lawry's seasoned salt. I can tell you, as a 15-year server, I started off with the California cut, which is 6 ounces. We have like 5 different cuts. And most people get the Lawry's cut because it's 10 ounces. It's our, kind of our medium size cut. But I have graduated. And if I were to go, I would get the Diamond Jim Brady cut, which is a 16-ounce bone-in cut. medium rare. That's what I would definitely be ordering. The most popular side dishes before and still currently is the cream corn and the cream spinach. Those two side items were on the cart, had been for a long, long time. They were a la carte, but they would be on the cart when the carver would come to the table. So after you know, selected your cut of beef and temperature, you had the option of adding the cream corn or cream spinach to your dinner. I think the first 7 years I worked at Lawry's, I had a little bit. I tried to have a little bit of corn every day. And then, of course, we all get older. And then my body said I can't do that anymore. But that's just, you know, that's just how good it is.
That was Tiffany Cody of Lawry's in Beverly Hills, where she's been a server for 15 years. Give her a visit on La Cienega's Restaurant Row. The pandemic has given us the time and distance to think more deeply about the idea of hospitality. After the loss of what we think of as traditional restaurant hospitality, many of us spent a year trying to be hospitable to ourselves or those closest to us. For many moms, their natural role of giver and carer nearly buckled under the strain of pandemic life. And of course, the role of host and guest extends beyond the act of feeding someone. In her thought-provoking book, Be My Guest, Priya Basile explores the meaning of generosity through the lens of food and beyond. Hi, Priya.
Hi, Evan.
So this notion of give and take and how hospitality runs into other aspects of our emotional life is really fascinating. Can we start with the word itself, its etymology, and what's wrapped up in that?
I was so intrigued to find out about the roots of hospitality when I was researching for this book. So one thing is that the word is, it shares a root with the word hostility. They both come from the Indo-European word gosti, which meant host, guest, and stranger simultaneously. And I thought that this kind of trio of words was so powerful and so interesting, because it seems to me that those are the three roles through which we move consciously or unconsciously throughout our lives.
It's really fascinating. And also you talk about hospitality as beginning at birth, where we are creatures that need everything done for us, and that you talk about raising children as ultimate hospitable act, and how maturity equals growing up. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it was a sort of transition that I felt myself going through in relation to my mother. I think the hospitality that we get from our parents, if we're lucky, is like no other that we experience in any parts of our lives. And as my mother gets older and also has been unwell in various ways, I noticed that she couldn't take care of me in the way that I was used to whenever I went home, even as an adult. She couldn't cook the things that I wanted. There was a couple of times I went home and she hadn't made my favorite dish. And in those moments, I sort of experienced what it might be not to have her around anymore. And it was such an uncomfortable and such a sad realization. Of course, one that's always present, but just in those particular instances, it was suddenly so vivid to me that something was changing, and that this was like a very natural part of life, that we are perhaps no longer offered the care that we always expected, but that a certain care is demanded of us in turn. And so it occurred to me that this shift from being a guest to being a host is one of the hallmarks of growing up and of reaching maturity, to take care more than to be taken care of.
Is there a role for the recipe itself in hospitality?
I think so. I was so intrigued thinking about recipes and how I described it in the book as one of the original open source, a kind of very beautiful form of exchange between cultures, between people, between generations. I think recipes, there's something implicitly generous in them, because of course you can adapt them or remain, you know, really faithful because you want to recreate something very particular. And the more you make a recipe, the more it becomes yours. I think that's something very beautiful too, the way in which food allows us to get very close to something and feel like it's somehow inextricably part of you, even if it might come from a place or an origin or a person who you don't know or who is very removed from you. And so this way of collapsing distance, of collapsing difference that recipes afford us is, I think, one of the most precious forms of exchange that we have and have had for many years. And of course, ever since blogs, food blogs and recipes on the internet began to proliferate and be so easily available, I feel as though that sense of exchange and bounty that's there through recipes has become even more accentuated.
We often talk about food as this way of connecting. Does it also cause division?
I remember a particular incident from my childhood because I grew up in an Indian community in Kenya. And the society at that time was quite divided. Kenya was part of the British Empire and it was sort of newly independent when I was born in 1977. And so as I was growing up in the 80s, the Indian community was quite segregated from the Black Kenyans and the white community. But within the Indian community, it was very diverse. So Hindus, Sikhs, Muslims, we all ate together, met, and there were kind of very close friendships. But I noticed that whenever our Muslim friends came to eat at our home, they wouldn't touch the meat because it wasn't halal. And this really offended my father, especially. And he would just start to rant and say, "That's it, I'm not seeing them again. I'm not inviting them. I'm not going there." But then a few weeks later, we would be invited and we would go there. And he would swear on the way that he wasn't going to touch the food. He wasn't going to touch the meat. But then once we were sitting at the table, he would help himself, tuck in, enjoy, have seconds, give compliments. And so there was this sense in which, you know, the food revealed the differences, and sometimes even in a kind of uncomfortable way. And at the same time, it had this power to seduce and sort of make my father get over his prejudice, which he had sworn to just a few weeks before.
So we have to talk about this phrase that over the past year on this show, we have uttered innumerable times, and that is hospitality industry, this pretty intense oxymoron. Can you talk about how hospitality has become commodified?
Yeah, it's got a different resonance now as well, though, with the pandemic and this particular part of our sort of economy being so badly affected. I sort of feel like I have a different relationship to that term that I had when I wrote it, when I wrote the book. But nevertheless, I think it still holds that this notion of hospitality, which had to do with giving without expecting anything in return, has now got this very strong connotation of paying to be served, and that those who pay deserve and those who can't pay don't. When I was researching, I noticed that when you Google hospitality, you just end up with different links to the restaurant industry, hotels, and this whole kind of leisure industry where you pay to be served. And it seemed to me a kind of sad indictment of this beautiful notion of hospitality, which, you know, it ties to religion, it ties to philosophy, it ties to politics. And it's just such an all-encapsulating term, which I think gives us a way to think about our relations to each other in a different way. But that this has been co-opted by this capitalist money-making industry. That seems like a real pity to me. But what I also think is that we've seen a tremendous generosity and inventiveness in the past year in how people who cook for a living and feed others for a living have adapted to try and keep going to survive, and also to give us so much comfort and joy and pleasure in difficult times. And even doing it to the point of, you know, not making a profit and even taking a loss sometimes. So I feel like the way that I set out thinking about that phrase, hospitality industry, has altered a bit over the past year.
It's interesting because as I read through this piece and thought about the beginning of the book and your initial musings on hospitality and maturity, I couldn't help but think of guests as bad actors, which we hear so many stories, and I fear for what's going to happen to those generous folks who have lost so much now that we're opening, if the guest doesn't understand that they're an implicit part of this exchange of hospitality.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good point, that this notion of reciprocity within this this under this umbrella of hospitality is really important, that we have our roles to play, and that for whether it's a dinner party or a meal in a restaurant, for it to really be successful, that we have our responsibilities. I mean, even if we're enjoying something and or paying for something, we nevertheless have a responsibility to kind of honor the other person, to take care of them, to be aware of their needs. I mean, in this pandemic time, I think that this question of what our role is, showing consideration to others, it has a different charge. I mean, just, you know, this question of like keeping the right distance, wearing a mask, all these things for me have become expressions of hospitality. And I think people have been tremendously, most people, I would say, have been tremendously considerate and even have sacrificed so much with a view to protecting and taking care of others. And so for me, this question of giving and giving up, host and guest and stranger, they're all related. It's like this kind of sort of shifting roles and responsibilities that are part of how we can live together better.
Well, Priya, thank you so much. This book is small but mighty. I know it's going to be something that I turn to over and over again, just so I can think about what wells up in reading it.
Thank you so much. It means so much to me to hear you say that, Evan.
Author and essayist Priya Basel is the co-founder of Authors for Peace, a political platform for artists and writers. Her latest work is Be My Guest. Big Chocolate and Corporate Responsibility. It's all being debated in the Supreme Court. We've got the details next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. The U.S. Supreme Court is set to rule on two cases as early as this week, known as Nestle USA Inc. versus John Doe and Cargill Inc. versus John Doe. The cases are holding the world's largest cocoa bean producer and a leading chocolate manufacturer accountable for child labor abuses in the global cocoa supply chain. Simran Sethi is here to explain the nuances of the cases and what the rulings could mean for chocolate companies. Hi, Simran.
Hi, Evan.
Where is most of the cocoa in the world grown, and who is the leading producer?
The majority of cocoa is grown in West Africa, and about 70% of it comes from two countries, Ghana and Ivory Coast. The organizations that are involved in the lawsuit are what are known as cocoa producers and chocolate manufacturers. So chocolate manufacturers are companies that we know behind some of our favorite candy bars. It's Nestle, Mars, Hershey. Nestle is in this particular lawsuit. And then there are cocoa producers. They're the processors who kind of get cocoa into the marketplace to confectioners and the like. And the one that's involved in this particular suit is Cargill.
Who's working on the cocoa plantations, and what are the working conditions?
So most cocoa in the world is grown by smallholder farmers, and these are folks who live at the margins. There was a study that was done a couple of years ago that showed that most of them are earning an estimated $1 per day. And even for certified cocoa, that for Fair Trade International did a study and found that the average household growing cocoa was below the World Bank's extreme poverty line. That has sort of been one of the reasons that so many children are involved, which is something that a lot of people don't realize is still a problem, but it's a big one. A recent study from the University of Chicago shows that about 1.56 million children work in cocoa production in just Ivory Coast and Ghana alone.
Wow.
Yeah.
The U.S. Supreme Court is set to rule on two cases before the June recess. Nestle's one of the world's leading chocolate manufacturers, as you said, and Cargill is the world's largest cocoa bean producer. Who are the John Does in the suits, and what are these plaintiffs alleging?
The John Does are six residents from Mali who allege that when they were between the ages of 12 and 14, they were trafficked from Mali to Ivory Coast and enslaved on cocoa plantations there. And according to their lawsuit, they were forced to work for 12 to 14 hours a day, at least 6 days a week. They weren't paid. They were given scraps of food to eat. They were beaten with whips and tree branches when the folks who were overseeing them felt that they weren't working quickly enough. And, you know, reading right from the lawsuit, they were forced to sleep on dirt floors, guarded by men with guns to prevent them from escaping. Respondents witnessed other children who tried to flee the plantations being severely beaten and tortured. One of the plaintiffs, John Doe 4, they all are under these, you know, pseudonyms and anonymous to protect them, said that they cut the bottoms of his feet and rubbed chili pepper into his wounds. And then he was also tied to a tree and beaten until his arm was damaged. John Doe 3 says he witnessed small children who tried to escape being forced to drink urine. And John Doe 6 also says that he was severely beaten for working too slowly, and that all of the kids, right, who are now adults, bear scars from this, both physical scars and emotional ones.
Has the rise in cocoa production in West Africa had a direct correlation to an increase in child labor?
That is absolutely what manufacturers say. There's absolutely been an increase in cocoa production, and we do see that the numbers have shifted accordingly. However, what I find interesting is that when we initially saw the challenges in child labor earlier on last year, the World Cocoa Foundation said, well, it's the pandemic. That's why more kids are now involved in, and I want to make a distinction here. There's child labor, and then there's what we call hazardous child labor. Hazardous child labor is when young children are working, you know, way too many hours. This is all established by the ILO, or they're working with machinery that's really dangerous, like a machete. They're exposed to pesticides. Like, this is the stuff that we're trying to avoid. And sometimes that distinction isn't made. And so a lot of folks think, oh, it's just, you know, kids doing chores on the family farm. I used to do that when I grew up, you know, when I was a kid. And this is not that. So what has been interesting is now the response from big cocoa companies is that, oh, it's because of an increase in production. So originally they said it was because of the pandemic, and now they're saying it's because of this increased production that child labor is actually increasing, and hazardous child labor is also increasing.
How far back do the complaints date as they have worked their way through district and appellate courts?
This is, for me, one of the most challenging parts about this, that these cases have been under litigation for a long time, well over a decade, and these children have now, adults, have never seen their day in court. Now we're reaching sort of the ultimate decision here in the Supreme Court under this particular rule, which is the Alien Tort Statute.
So explain that. Explain the federal ATS law and how now Nestle and Cargill are contesting that it does not apply to these cases.
Right. So what it is really was created for was, it was adopted back in 1789 to enable aliens, which are foreign nationals, to bring lawsuits to U.S. courts for a tort, right? So hence Alien Tort Statute. And a tort is physical, legal, or economic harm that a victim could be awarded financial compensation for. So, and this was in violation of international law. Now, what Nestle and Cargill maintain is that, listen, we know child slavery is terrible, hazardous child labor is terrible, but that this case is not within the scope of the ATS. So they're pushing the high court to rule that domestic corporations cannot be held to account under the Alien Tort Statute, and they're really trying to make sure that foreign corporations are exempt from liability.
So how will the Supreme Court ruling affect child labor laws in the cocoa industry moving forward? I would imagine that it's, you know, this case will be resolved, but the fight will be far from over.
You are absolutely right. The resolution of the case allows the suits to move forward and for these folks from Mali to finally have their day in court. It doesn't change the mechanism of child enslavement or hazardous child labor. This is an issue that has been going on for decades. And back in 2001, there were two actual U.S. senators who put together a plan to eradicate child labor in cocoa. And Big Cocoa got together with them and said, hey, listen, we're going to take care of this problem ourselves. And all of them got together, the major chocolate companies and cocoa producers, and that included Nestle and Cargill, and said, we will reconcile this problem in 4 years. And we will ensure that all of our cocoa beans and all their derivative products will have been produced without any of the worst forms of child labor. Here we are in 2021, and we still have not achieved that goal. And in fact, every interim goal, the Big Chocolate kind of pushed the goal and said, okay, we can't achieve it by 2001 goes to 2005, 2005 to 2010, 2010 to 2015. And now they're saying that they'll cover most of the supply chain by 2025. So the goalpost keeps moving.
As consumers, what can we look at on chocolate package that gives us an indication? Is there anything aside from the obvious move, at least here in LA, which is to buy from a bean to bar company who is very transparent about how they source their cocoa beans?
Unfortunately, there is no certification protocol or oversight around ensuring chocolate is slavery free. So what I would recommend folks do, there's actually in the article that I wrote for The Counter, there's a link to an amicus brief. And the craft chocolate makers that signed on to that brief have given a guarantee that they do not source from any enslaved labor and they do not use hazardous child labor in the production of their products. I would say if you don't have immediate access to that list, that what you suggested is a really solid starting point. We've been conditioned to believe that cocoa should be should be extraordinarily cheap, but this is coming at an excruciating price.
That's Simran Sethi, author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. To read her piece on the Supreme Court's forthcoming rule on Big Chocolate for the Counter, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. We'll also have a link to a list of craft chocolate makers here in Los Angeles. When Good Food continues, we've got a tutorial on making your own root beer this summer, plus a primer on refreshing, delicious cider. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. My mother's favorite treat was a root beer float. Because of this, I was along for the tasting ride from A&W draft root beer to esoteric craft bottled versions. It always struck me as a kind of strange beverage, something that straddled the line of sweet and savory. It's all down to the aromatic spices that are the backbone of the beverage. Peter Balawanian of Spice Station wants us to make our own, and I'm here to say yes, please. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Evan.
How are you?
Well, I'm great, and I'm happy to talk about root beer.
Me too. So the name, root beer, it's called that for a reason, right?
It's basically a root or a bunch of roots that are put together for, at the time, back I think in the colonial days, where they had very little alcohol in it, and it all came from these certain roots that came out to become, you know, their drink.
So give us the backbone of the drink. What are the roots or other spices that we need to have to make it?
I've made root beer once in my life. Obviously, it's a process. You do have to love root beer, and I do love root beer, but in the last 15 years, I've stopped drinking soda pop, so I just never had the opportunity to make something and drink it. But when I did make it, the main ingredient that you need to have is sassafras. That is the main ingredient. That actually gives you that aroma of root beer. If you even smell the sassafras root, you will smell root beer. It's almost like turning the cap upside down of an A&W. But definitely, with sassafras, you would also need to put some sarsaparilla, which also it's on itself used to be a pop back in the day, cherry bark, and licorice root. Those were the four main that I used. On top of that, I added a little bit of vanilla, obviously the sugar, and I did the yeast. So I did the traditional way because there's two ways now of making it. You could do it with the yeast or you can do it with carbonated water.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to infuse all the roots and barks into a water and then they turn that into a syrup, which they then add some soda water and ice to.
That seems to be the norm nowadays because everybody has those carbonated water makers at home. And simple syrup is obviously good to keep. They usually make root beer simple syrup style and then do a kind of like a one part to three parts the carbonated water when it comes down to serving. But they're the traditional ways with basically using yeast.
Right. And then you bottle everything and the carbon dioxide builds up in the bottle.
Yes, the yeast eats out of the sugar and basically creates the carbonation. And voila, you got your pop and root beer flavors. Now, there's other flavors that people use a lot in root beers. Some of them are birch bark, burdock root, which again is another one. Birch is another drink that they had back in the day on its own, but it easily comes into root beer. Then there's also people that use, instead of, let's say, sugar, brown sugar, they can use malt syrup, they can use molasses, they could use honey. All of that has been used, and I've tasted most of them. Then there's other ingredients like star anise, juniper berries, obviously cinnamon. Cinnamon is always cool to have, even if you're going to put one stick, it kind of gives you that jump, you know, especially if you're doing a cassia stick. It has a bit more of a sharpness to the flavor. So these are all flavors that can all go in to the root beer.
And some people I notice use ginger.
Yeah, ginger as well. Ginger and dandelion root. Ginger is something that also gives you that kind of like, you know, that wasabi flavor in your mouth. And the root beer has that a little bit, but because it's so sweet, it kind of balances each other out. But yeah, ginger is definitely that. And then they also use live ginger to also give it a little bit of, some people have done it that way. Somebody brought it to me to make carbonation from live ginger.
So interesting. Where does sassafras bark come from? Is it an international ingredient or is it a U.S. product?
I get mine from Louisiana. I get it from swampland. I mean, it literally grows, the trees grows in the U.S., southern U.S., and they're damp. When I get my bits, they're big chunks of wood that are soaked, and then I have to dry them myself, and it takes me a few weeks sometimes to dry them completely, or you can start getting mold. And my area usually smells like root beer when I just received my batch.
I love that. Cool. I love that you actually get damp roots.
I get damp roots. But it's great because it's a lot of flavor. And I remember when I kind of had my supply switch and I went straight in getting it from, you know, I guess you want to call it a farmer or a harvester that harvested this. They basically send them to me, you know, wrapped in newspaper, you know, because obviously it's damp. And I take them out. I still put them under the sun. And I have to take them out put them in cardboard boxes so that it takes out all the humidity. But when I remember one of my first clients that purchased it, the new batch, because usually they used to be chips. And the new batch was like big pieces of wood chunks. And he called me back and he says, "You guys made a mistake. I received a bunch of wood instead of sassafras." And I had to explain to him, but just open the bag and smell it and then tell me what you think. I said, you're gonna love using this.
And what about sarsaparilla? What does it smell like? Can you describe the aroma?
It's kind of a cross between vanilla and I guess a little bit of sassafras. I mean, you know how the cream sodas used to smell like? Mm-hmm. That's the closest to what I get when it comes to the sarsaparilla root.
And there always seems to be a bit of vanilla added to these recipes. What does the vanilla do to the flavor?
Vanilla is like the umami in the drinks. it kind of, if you put just enough of it, it goes on almost undetected in a sense where people can't tell it's in there, but it gels everything together. And if you do it right, if you get the right vanilla, the beans, if they're fresh, then it really adds also a little bit of this almost chocolatey thing where it's, you know, you think it's, how does that happen? But it melts them all together, the flavors, and it works really well. And that's why vanilla is always added a little bit to a lot of different things.
So interesting. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care, Evan. Thank you for having me.
That's Peter Balawanian. He's the owner of Spice Station. He gave up his storefront in Silver Lake, but you can still find all of his inventory, including that fresh sassafras bark, online. Visit him at spicestationsilverlake.com. Now, what would Johnny Appleseed think of the modern cider craze? Cider production is booming in the U.S. Similar to wine, cider's all about the fruit and the terroir. Dan Pucci and Craig Cavallo have us following the dropped apple seeds as they traverse the country in their book, American Cider. Hi, Dan. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Evan.
Hey, nice to be here.
I'm glad to have both of you. It's a really interesting book. Is the history of cider in America one of aristocrats?
The short answer to that question is yes, it is one of aristocracy, but that's just kind of one dimension. Cider was so prevalent in the country that it was essentially everywhere where apples could grow. And to that end, there were folks of an aristocratic social status that were engaged in cider to a completely different extent and caliber than you might have found with sort of the more subsistence farmers with less access to large swaths of land.
So apples are this really interesting crop from a genetic viewpoint. Every single seed in every single apple creates something different from its neighbor housed in that core. So there's this amazing genetic diversity when you plant from seed. Then as we get into a time when when humans are intervening and they start grafting, things change. Apples become more stabilized and certain varieties begin to come to the fore. Was our early cider landscape mostly filled with cider made from these wild sour apples a la Johnny Appleseed, or were they really made in a more intentional way with varietals of apples?
In the beginning, most of the history of cider in the United States is from these seedling apples. And those wild apples are generally what most people were drinking across the United States. Seedling apples could be grown without very little work from a farmer on a diversified farm and could basically make cider with pretty little effort on, and that really didn't have any value to it. We do see some parts of the United States growing cider varieties in the history, especially in the Southeast on these large plantations with varieties like Hughes crab, and in places, unlikely enough, as Newark, New Jersey, which has four historical varieties, Povachon, Campfield, Harrison, and Granny Winkle, which are historic and grown in Newark, which was reportedly to be the best cider in the United States, really not the world, in most of the 19th century.
When we talk about cider, are we talking about a product that's brewed like beer or fermented like wine?
This is Dan. We're talking about a product fermented like wine. An integral part of the brewing process is a cooking process, which extracts sugars from malted barley or grain, which you need to cook the grains to extract that sugar. But with cider, that sugar is already accessible because the juice itself is naturally sweet and it has sugar in it. So it doesn't need to have to go through a cooking process like beer to be able to get fermentable sugars.
So basically you press the fruit just like you would press grapes. And then what happens with the juice once you've collected that free-flowing juice?
This is Craig. There's a number of things you can do. That's sort of where you get into cider maker philosophy, and those are individual, unique decisions that are made that affect the final product. But ultimately, if there's enough sugar, which apples have, that juice, it'll go into a vessel, which is another decision. But to cut to the point, the juice will start to ferment naturally. You can also add commercial yeast to start that fermentation sooner. But that juice will ferment, and then again, there's a number of decisions to be made as to whether or not you want to ferment it out totally dry, which means the yeast consume all of the sugar, or if you want to bottle with some residual sugar to maintain some CO2 or bubbles, which are a natural byproduct of the fermentation. But yes, you press the fruit, you ferment the juice, and then you bottle or can or keg the product.
So let's jump to today. Let's jump to what's happening now in the modern cider business. How big is it getting? When did sort of the boom start?
The boom really started to take off in 2014, 2015. There were about 150 cideries in 2010. And I think that doubled by that period of time. And now we're close to 1,000. I think there's now a cidery in every state. So many of those early cideries that started 10 years ago were using apples that were culled from eating apple orchards. And now a lot more intentional cider orchards going in the ground that are either just coming online now or on the verge of being in production the next few years. That's going to really change the landscape of cider in the United States.
So let's talk about sort of the flavor profile of ciders. This balance of tannin and sweet and acid.
Yeah, cider's flavor is really complex and can really get a lot of different flavors to it. You can have ciders that are distinctly apple-y. Like last night, we had some delicious cider from Spokane, Washington, from Liberty, who made a great Gravenstein. And that was very fresh and fruity and apple-y. And just next to it, we had this very delicious cider made from English varieties that was savory and earthy and mushroom and tannic. And cider has a really great food flexible pairing capabilities because of its lower alcohol than wine, and that kind of interplay of sweet, sour, and savory and tannins. It can be really interesting.
If you were going to pick for a total newbie cider drinker, two ciders, one very approachable, maybe more on the sweet side, the second a bit more savory, which two would you pick for us?
I think for ones that you can find in California, Yonder Cider, which is a new cider company from out of Wenatchee, Washington, which is kind of where much of the apples in the United States are grown, is really great. They're really fresh. They're all made from really amazing varieties, and they are crisp and fresh and easy drinking and fruit forward. They come in 16-ounce cans, and they're definitely like, there's no barrier of entry to tasting those products. And then I think on a more serious side, like some hometown heroes, like Tilted Shed up in Sonoma County, or Scar of the Sea, based in St. Louis Obispo, are both like really excellent, really great ciders.
Well, thank you so much. It's been incredibly interesting.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us. Nice chatting with you.
Yes, thank you.
That's Dan Pucci and Craig Cavallo. Their book is American Cider. The Market Report is next. And yes, it is still cherry season. Stay close. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. And now for an antidote for June gloom, let's head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where Jillian Ferguson joins us with this report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. Next weekend marks the second annual Pies for Justice fundraiser from the group Gather for Good. And Pies for Justice is an event that started last summer on Juneteenth, and it's now become a yearly tradition. Over 40 chefs and bakers and restaurateurs from around the city are participating, either raffling off pies or donating a portion of their daily sales to benefit two organizations, Black Lives Matter LA and Supermarket over in Leimert Park. And I'm talking talking now with one of the participants, Martin Drelick, who is the chef de cuisine at Post and Beam in Baldwin Hills. Hi, Martin.
How are you?
I'm well. So this is your second year participating in Pies for Justice. Tell us what you and Chef John Cleveland over at Post and Beam have planned.
So we're going to actually be debuting our pizza program that week. So we're going to use this as a jump off for that. Specifically, we're going to be doing, I believe, a peach and spicy sausage from Pizza Barnett Pizza with like some summer basils, balsamic, and probably some cream sauce as well. So, should be pretty good.
That's awesome. And I understand that pretty much every single part of this pizza is coming from here at the farmer's market. Is it true that you're milling your own flour at the restaurant?
It is, yeah. Chef John, it's a program that Chef John got into with Sherry from Wiser Farms sometime before I ever got in there. And yeah, he's got a giant miller that we've been doing all our flours and all of our grains for. So yeah, everything is coming from the market.
And so with the sausage, is it a spicy sausage that you're using?
I'd like to. I have to see what Oliver has. I'm not totally sure yet. I haven't actually spoken with him. But I know he does have spicy and black pepper sausages as well as like a regular one. So if we can't get the spicy one, we'll throw some kind of spice into the pizza itself.
Okay. And when you're picking out peaches for pizza specifically, what are you looking for?
Ones that are still a little bit firm. You don't want them too ripe, because obviously they'll just turn to mush in the oven. But basically something a little sweet to complement the spiciness of the sausage, and obviously with a little bit of acid in there so that it cuts through the fattiness of it as well. So definitely nothing that's overripe.
Okay, and what kind of cheese is on this pizza?
I'm thinking about smoked mozzarella or smoked goat cheese. Something smoked, definitely, though. Something smoked.
Great. All right. And if anyone listening is into making their own pizza at home right now, whether it's in their oven or on a grill, what tips do you have for people at home making pizza?
Definitely preheat the oven. Let your dough proof so it can develop as much flavor as possible. And then, just get creative. Get creative. You don't have to stick to any recipe. It's just a guideline. It's not law. So.
That's right. Come to the market, see what's in season, and just absolutely. Throw it on top, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, Martin. Well, it's great to see you thriving over at Post and Beam. I can't wait to order some pizzas this Friday.
Thank you very much.
That was Martin Drelick. He is the chef de cuisine at Post and Beam in Baldwin Hills. You can also see Martin in the Netflix series on episode 3 of High on the Hog. It is a must watch. And this Friday, Martin will be serving pizzas as part of Gather for Good's second annual Pies for Justice Fund. Fundraiser. This is a community event happening next weekend in support of social justice. All proceeds benefit Black Lives Matter LA and Supermarket in Leimert Park. It's also just a celebration of the full reopening of LA restaurants. So check out the website to find out who's participating and how you can order a pie. It's andgatherforgood.com. Another exciting event this week is the return of Andy's Orchard Stone Fruit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market this coming Wednesday. David Karp is, of course, LA's famous fruit detective. He is an intrepid fruit journalist and the co-owner of Andy's Orchard with Andy Mariani up in Morgan Hill. And David joins us today with a preview of what we have to look forward to. Hello.
Hi. Delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you. So we all look forward to the return of Andy's Orchard because it really marks the beginning of summer. What do we have to look forward to this week?
Well, cherries took their own sweet time because it was preternaturally chilly close to the coast. So we're 7 to 10 days later than normal, but we'll have primo Bing cherries, which are less and less grown in California because with global warming, they tend to develop spurs and doubles, which are commercial flaws, in the warmer growing areas. Closer to the coast, it's still possible to grow them because it doesn't get as hot in the summer. But we also don't get as cold in the winter. So having a really big crop of high-quality cherries is a blessing for us. We'll have Rainiers. Next week, we'll have Black Republicans. And this week will be probably the last Black Tartarians. Those are our four main varieties, along with a few Van cherries, and then a scattering of other things, a few sour cherries, a few oddball cherries.
So I'm looking at these cherries right now. You've brought me a preview, and I want to focus on the Rainiers because they are almost the size of apricots. They are absolutely enormous. Is this because you're just waiting so long to pick the cherries?
Steroids. No. No. It's because they're grown where cherries could and should be grown, or were when people had a choice of where to grow them. These are grown by Andy's Orchard, by Andy Mariani, the patron saint of specialty stone fruit, in Morgan Hill, which is near Gilroy, famous for garlic, and south of San Jose. So it's at the tail end of what used to be known as the Valley of Heart's Delight and now is Silicon Valley. It gets cool at night and warm during, sweet enough during the day to sweeten the cherries, and cool enough at night so the trees respire and the fruit stays on the trees long enough to develop this huge size. These are like 8-row cherries because they used to be packed by hand. Can you imagine? Individually placed, and that was how big a box was. It would be 8. That's pretty rare these days. So I'm not a sucker generally for large fruit. In fact, excessively large is often less flavorful. When it comes to cherries, it's a premium cherry.
All right. And then the other varieties you mentioned are the Black Tartarians and this variety with a very intriguing name, the Black Republican. What's the story behind that?
Black Republican was actually named by the Llewellings, who were nurserymen and growers in Oregon during the Civil War to annoy their pro-slavery neighbors. They were abolitionists themselves. And so it is a very dark cherry, and they were naming it for Republican because that was in favor of the cause that they supported. The amazing thing about it is not just the history, but the flavor. At its best, and it needs to be really fully ripe to be at its best, it has a winey, dark, almost chocolatey flavor that's unique among, it's just the quintessential black cherry flavor. Where did it get that from? Well, we've actually planted a small orchard of Black Eagle, the father of the Black Republican, and that way madness lies. It's so incredibly intense in flavor. And, of course, the progeny of Black Republican was the Bing. That's where it gets its excellence.
Wow. When are the Black Republicans going to be at the market?
That's going to be on the 23rd, very likely. I mean, we may have just a very few on the 16th, but if we've got 3 cases of them, look for them on the 23rd. We'll have a ton of them.
All right. Well, I think that the takeaway from all this is that everyone should start getting to the market an hour earlier than they are used to if they want to get this great fruit. We are looking forward to seeing you on Wednesday. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much, Jillian.
That was David Karp, pomologist and farmer behind Andy's Orchard. He will be at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market starting this coming Wednesday, June 16th. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and Paul Smith. I'm Evan Kleiman. Are you following Good Food on Instagram yet? If not, hit the follow button. We're at KCRW Good Food. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.